Hello, welcome. Just got a few people, remaining people filtering in, but we'll get underway. This is session 8B, Beyond the Greeks, Managing Unhedgeable Risk, by being presented by Wade Madison, Jeff Gebler and John Tyndall. My name's Richard Cornwell and I'll be your chair for today. This will just follow the usual format. These gentlemen will do their presentation and there'll be some time for questions and answers at the end. Do you want questions during the presentation? Are you happy to take questions during the presentation or we'll leave them to the end? Yeah, leave questions till the end. Anyway, our presenters are Wade Madison on the far left. Wade's a senior consultant and leader of Milliman's Australian Financial Risk Management Practice. He joined the firm in 2004 and is responsible for product development and risk management for clients throughout the Asia-Pacific region. Wade specialises in financial risk management and guarantee product development. Prior to establishing the Australian practice, Wade was based in Milliman's London office. During this time, Wade was involved with more than a dozen product developments and risk management assignments throughout the UK, Europe and North American markets. Wade has also led a number of product development and risk management assignments in the Asia-Pacific region. Since relocating back to Australia, Wade has worked on a wide range of wealth management institutions on product development and risk management projects, including insurance companies, platforms and superannuation funds. Wade has more than 10 years of experience across the United Kingdom, Europe, Australia and North America. Prior to joining Milliman, he spent 5 years with a global actuarial consultancy where he was responsible for the development and implementation of risk management systems. And Wade's written a number of articles on the subjects of product development and risk management, as well as having presented on the topic at conferences. I'll just introduce the other two gentlemen as well. Jeff is a consultant with the Australian Financial Risk Management Practice of Milliman's. Responsibilities include assisting clients with development, capital requirements and risk management of retirement guarantee products. Jeff joined Milliman in 2004 as a member of the Chicago Financial Risk Management Practice. Before transferring to Australia, Jeff worked on numerous retirement guarantee projects, product developments and pricing, financial projections and development of programs designed to manage the embedded risk on an ongoing basis. In addition to working on US projects, Jeff has focused on Milliman's European clients, including helping to launch the first retirement guarantees in Germany and Spain. Since transferring to Milliman's Australian practice, Jeff has been involved in numerous local product development and risk management assignments. John Tyndall is also working with Milliman's financial risk management practice in Australia to assist clients in bringing investment guarantee products to the Asia-Pacific region. Responsibilities include product development, capital requirement calculations, and risk management of financial guarantees. Prior to joining Milliman, John worked as a senior analyst for JP Morgan based in Sydney. This followed a five-year stint at QBE Insurance, also as a senior analyst based in Sydney. John has presented and published papers on swap and swaption pricing as well as applications for weather derivatives. So you can see they have lots of practical experience on the topic they're talking about. So without further ado, Wade.
Great. Thanks, Richard. Just got a few slides to kick off with, and apologies in advance for anyone that that attended earlier this morning. There's a little bit of repetition, so I'll try and take a slightly different approach and talk to it in maybe a different way. I think it's fair to say that, you know, the development of guaranteed products, particularly around retirement savings, is a key issue, and it's, you know, it's one of the, I guess, the pitfalls of, you know, the prevalence of a defined contribution system that at the end of the day, you know, the result of that is that risk around investment risk and longevity risk is passed back onto the, you know, the shoulders of the consumer. And essentially in other markets around the world, you know, various products have evolved incorporating guarantees of one kind or another to try and address these types of risk, particularly in the absence of, I guess, an appetite for people to invest in your traditional annuity style products. We've seen a range of guarantees that essentially overlay over mutual funds, and you know, the key aspects to these types of products and why they're really, you know, why they are so popular is really down to the fact that, you know, consumers at the end of the day retain all the original flexibility that existed on their existing defined contribution accumulation or drawdown product. So they retain allocation to equity markets. They have flexibility to dictate how and when they want to draw down on that income. And all that is factored in and needs to be considered when you're looking at risk managing these types of things. So, there's always a trade-off. You know, at the expense of introducing additional flexibility, it comes with cost and uncertainty about how do you predict the type of behaviour that people will exhibit when they want to start utilising this guarantee. And so it's fairly well established that the market risk and those types of aspects in these products are easily managed through fairly sophisticated hedging programs, but there's a range of issues around longevity risk, demographic risk, and other things that are a bit harder to manage that need to be considered as well. In terms of keeping it simple, I guess if we look in overseas markets, there's a whole wealth of products that are out there and all sorts of range of complexity and bells and whistles and different types of features. I guess from an Australian perspective, I see it in a relatively simplistic way, that there are two types of things we're trying to look at providing people with as they approach their retirement phase. And in simplistic terms, we're really looking at straightforward asset protection. So someone potentially doesn't want to commit to taking income, but they also don't want to sacrifice any assets that they've accumulated over a fairly lengthy period of accumulation. And that's typically your GMAB style product, stands for Guaranteed Minimum Accumulation Benefit, which is really just a put option. So there's not a huge degree of, demographic risk that sits in this thing. And Jeff and John will talk about it in a bit more detail later on. The other product's a bit more interesting because it focuses much more on the income and longevity side of things. And looking at the US market and sort of emerging in the UK and European markets, by far and away the product of choice that people are flocking to as these guarantees develop over there. And it really is about providing a guaranteed minimum income on an existing drawdown style product. So letting people retain all those flexible options and how they utilise those withdrawals and set their own asset allocation and those types of things. Versions exist that provide guaranteed income for life as well as an income over a more fixed time horizon. So in an Australian context, the way you might think about it is, people with relatively large balances with this type of lifetime income can generate a reasonably sized income level out of that, whereas people with lower levels of income when factoring in a social security underpin, it might be more sensible that they want to take out larger amounts but over a shorter time horizon. And then rely on the age pension later on. So the risks that bundle into these things essentially break down into two categories. And unsurprisingly, you have a range of hedgeable risks, which are generally your market-related risks, although there's a range of, market-related risks that are either difficult to hedge or prohibitive in terms of the cost to hedge. Essentially what we've seen in overseas markets is in terms of companies to try and manage this cost, they resort to utilising exchange-traded instruments where possible, although in some cases they may utilise investment banks for various structures, but it really is an exercise in trying to manage and control the cost while getting a good trade-off on the risk management profile. In terms of unhedgeable, there's a range of things that need to be considered. So there's issues around basis mismatch, correlation, changing correlations over time, which are fairly difficult to find appropriate instruments for. And then there's a whole, list of things around the demographic and behavioural risks. And I guess my argument to I want to make to that is, In the sense of as an insurance industry, those types of risks are something that we're used to taking. Mortality risk is something that is part of the natural skill set of that as an industry we've had. And I think what the guys will talk about sort of through this is one of the key aspects of this is to understanding how those types of risks flow through to these new or next generation products. So I'll hand it over to Jeff, and he can start walking us through some of the risks.
Thanks, Wade. So as Wade said, these products are new, absolutely, and then also new to Australia. There's a little bit more than 10 years of experience in the United States, but it's important to consider that the early benefits were mainly GMDB death benefits and also income benefits. And over time, mostly in the last 5 years, the withdrawal benefits have become much more popular. Those sales outnumber the death benefits. So it's clear that living benefits are the way forward. With that being said, though, as from an insurance company's perspective, credible data is really hard to come by. Sorry. Okay. So while you can hedge the main underlying risk, and so if you think about a guaranteed minimum accumulation benefit, the largest risk is that at the end of the term you don't have the capital there to pay off. And so while that is hedgeable, it's important to, through product design, to shape investor behavior. And also another thing to consider is to look at what's really expensive from the guarantee's perspective versus what does the customer appreciate. So sometimes benefits get considered that might not be appreciated by the consumer, and for that reason you might want to not offer those. And also, there in the United States mainly, the guaranteed products are seen as a way to increase funds under management, whereas you could also look at the guarantee as something that's profitable in its own right, and that's going to be important when pricing and when looking at what demographic risks are important. So the guaranteed products are VA-style products. They've been successful largely because of the underlying flexibility. And while there might be a long-term guarantee on top of that, generally the policyholder has the option to pull the money out at any point in time. Now, in the United States, there's usually an upfront surrender period. In Australia, it's looking like that might not be marketable. And the flexibility is, as the customer sees it, it's a rider that sits on top of a managed fund. So the way lapses factor into pricing the guarantee is that lapses will reduce the cost of the guarantee. And what that results in is a cross-subsidy. So the policyholders that are choosing to lapse are in essence paying for the people that are sticking around. And the experience in the United States supports this. And sometimes from a capital markets perspective, it's a hard thing to grasp because to surrender a financial option that has an intrinsic value is technically irrational, but it does happen. And in the same way, from a typical managed fund, if you look at customer behavior, when the market goes down, you would see outflows of the fund. And that you could view that in the same way as being irrational behavior. So where to start with developing the lapse assumptions with so little credible data? Well, there seems to be two ways to think about it. One is to just look at normal underlying lapse behavior for managed funds as a place to start. On the other hand, I think sometimes people can get too technical and you might find a room of PhDs trying to develop lapse behavior over little experience. And also, it's sometimes reasonable to assume that lapse behavior is going to be affected by the fund performance. So you might expect more people to stick around when the guarantee is in the money after the fund value has decreased. And the way that to manage this is with product design, really. Ratchets is a feature that would reset the policyholder at a new higher level after a strong fund performance. And the reason for this is because otherwise they might have no reason to stick around the product. If the guarantee is no longer relevant, there's no reason to keep them from switching to another fund or another investment option. And what's relevant to Australia is that it's an advisor-driven market with online platforms. So gone are the days where people might wait a year to see an investment statement showing their fund performance relevant to the guarantee. And And here's where the interaction between the base product, which you can consider it as the base variable annuity in the States, or just the managed fund, whereas the lapses are going to make the guarantee cheaper, they're also not good for the... You want to keep persistency in the managed fund. So mortality is particularly relevant to the guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefits, the GMWBs. For the short-term capital projection, GMABs, it's not so important. And so the most popular withdrawal benefits now in the States are the lifetime income benefits, which generally provide a guaranteed minimum level for the lifetime of the policyholder. And as you can see, that if longevity improves, that would make these guarantees more expensive. But it's also important that the mortality and longevity risk is core to the insurance business, and that's similar to the lifetime annuities. There are arguments, and many companies in the States do feel that the anti-selection issue is not as important for these hybrid investment products. So generally in pricing a lifetime withdrawal benefit, this sort of risk would be factored into the pricing, and the margins aren't terribly substantial. There is a developing mortality derivatives market. You wouldn't say that it's liquid, but there's definitely potential for growth. Although basis risk is still an issue, and basis risk is that in any sort of mortality swap, or the ones currently available, the underlying pool of lives would be different than the lives that the business is issued on. And there's also natural hedges with other products. So if you think of existing life insurance, if a company has a book of life insurance policies, there will be a natural offset there. And also death benefit riders, which aren't popular in their own right, which means that policyholders aren't requesting those up front. But in marketing, you generally see that from a policyholder's perspective, they would they find it hard to stomach that if they invest their money in a lifetime withdrawal benefit or accumulation benefit, if they were to die, they would get none of the benefit that they've paid for to date. So including a death benefit on top of a lifetime withdrawal benefit, if it's priced properly, will offer some sort of an offset to longevity risk. So the withdrawals we're talking about here, mainly relevant to the lifetime withdrawal benefits, but also in a lot of the capital guarantee products such as the GMABs, there is the option to take out an excess withdrawal. And the way the products are typically structured is that the policyholder has, at minimum, they're guaranteed their withdrawal amount, but they have the flexibility to take more or less, and that could be due to short-term cash needs or various other reasons. Also, there's generally the option to delay taking withdrawals until the income is needed. And so from the company's perspective, this is going to reduce the cost of the guarantee if they're allowed that option, because the later withdrawals are taken, the later claims occur. And when allowing for excess withdrawals, the way to manage it is that the withdrawals should dilute the guarantee, so that there's no incentive to game the system by taking withdrawals at different points. So generally, just proportionally reduces the underlying guarantee. Now, in a hedging program, there's the question of how would you manage the possibility that withdrawals could start at different times. The typical approach is the cohort approach, which is you would split your block of business into a list of policies for each policy, which each cohort having a different withdrawal characteristic. And then, but as that policyholder begins taking withdrawals, then the cohorts disappear. And in pricing, you can offer bonuses in deferral periods that, while they can be generous to the policyholder, it can end up being, if priced properly, You can offer bonuses and deferrals that make the cost neutral, which means from a company's perspective, whenever they decide to begin taking withdrawals, it's the same cost. Or think of it, the savings can also be greater than the cost of the delay incentive. So despite the overall negative savings rate in America, the VA market has done pretty well. And generally, it's a single premium deposit, and that's the result of a 401k lump sum at the end of employment, which is somewhat similar to the Australian market. Any sort of guaranteed product that would sit inside of an Australian super in the accumulation phase, that wouldn't be the case. And so many companies are considering, besides a single premium investment guarantee, to include some sort of ongoing premium product. And that's going to introduce some uncertainty, because every successive guarantee is you're essentially purchasing a shorter term option, and options generally get cheaper as the term increases. And also, there's a problem with anti-selection, because as market conditions change, for example, if interest rates rise, people might be less likely to, the guarantee would be less relevant, they'd be less likely to use that. And also, since future premium contribution patterns aren't certain, it's difficult to hedge. So there's a range of issues to consider. Should each contribution be guaranteed at the same cost? So should, if an ongoing premium product is structured, should each premium add to the, should it be additive? One example is the Axa North product, as an example of a VA in Australia where future contributions are limited to a smaller percentage of the initial investment. Or the way it works in the States is that the policyholder always has the option to contribute more. Certainly no company is going to turn away additional deposits, but it's usually at current prices. And so the thing to consider there is an ongoing premium product dictated by the market, which was the case in Germany with the AXA TwinStar, where it was competing against existing regular contributions to fixed annuities. But in the States, there isn't, they're not necessarily savers as much. The lump sum is the biggest portion, and then later contributions can just be included at current rates. And the problem to hedge based on expected future contributions is that you can often get yourself in the situation where the hedges on the books are much larger than the actual premiums collected. So, for example, if you had a income product that was designed to take regular premiums over, say, 30 years of employment, and at day one you have one year's worth of premium to hedge for 30 years of expected premiums would set you up for a fall if interest rates rose and the guarantee was no longer relevant, so people decided to stop making future contributions, and then there's a large hedge in place. And at that, I'll turn it over to John Tindall.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm going to talk pretty briefly about some of the market-related risks, some of the less hedgeable ones, and I guess similar to the way Jeff was presenting it, I'm going to show you some solutions on the left-hand side, show you some issues on the left-hand side, and hopefully explain a few solutions on the right-hand side. So first of all, asset allocation. Evidence from other markets, primarily in the US, is that they've attempted to keep the pricing structure pretty simple, I guess mainly as a marketing ploy. By keeping it simple means you're basically charging one price regardless of the asset allocations that are selected by the investor. Whilst they might be able to select from a small range of asset allocations, the price being flat would suggest that you would get some types of selection issues there. But evidence to date is that, as we see time and time again, the investor isn't as savvy as the efficient market hypothesis, and they don't do exactly what they should do. Um, new markets, Australia and other developing economies in terms of these types of products, have a fairly clean slate in the terms that we can approach it probably in a more equitable way without stepping on too many toes and losing too much business at the same time. So a move to more differentiated pricing where you the price that you're charging for the guarantee more closely represents the asset allocation and hence the risks that are involved in providing that sort of guarantee. The biggest issue you have is, of course, complexity. You need to sell these products, so any complexity in terms of a differentiated pricing scheme has to be minimised to some extent. And some of the ways you might go about that, as mentioned there, is to create, say, a high, low, medium bucket of risk. So you might have a selection of model portfolios or asset allocations that you can put into these high, medium and low risks, each one attracting a different price. It also has the advantage of if investors wish to change their asset allocations over time, they have a schedule there which would outline if they move from this allocation to this allocation, they might move from a low bucket to a medium bucket, or they might go from a medium bucket to a high bucket. And each bucket would attract a separate price. Restricting the equity portion of the funds offered is a common way to do it. Obviously, removing that sort of flexibility is not desirable. You would like to keep the ability of the investor to, well, at least let them believe that it is in their power to choose an asset allocation that is going to be appropriate for them in the long term. Other issues around these sorts of things is to obviously limit the number of transfers or even charge nominally for the transfers. You could require an asset allocation model and a charge accordingly. Of course, you're getting into, as you go down that track more and more, the complexity, I guess the transparency of the pricing comes into question. But it removes a lot of the selection issues that come around the asset allocation question. And although the investors may not be rational at the moment, you can only assume that as time goes on and these products become more prevalent that people will start to realise these pricing anomalies and try to exploit them. Basis risk, can never get rid of it, but there are some things we can do about it. Generally, we're talking about just the difference between the underlying and the hedge instruments. In an investment guarantee, the underlying is a managed fund, which is a collection of securities in a variety of exchanges, and you're hedging it via a single index. So, basis risk is something you can never get rid of. Whilst on average, it might zero out if the index weights estimators are unbiased for over shorter time horizons. Of course, it doesn't zero out. The way you manage the basis risk is the way you select the funds that you will offer under the guarantee. So when you approach a client who's looking to offer guarantees over a range of funds, you need to go through a process to understand the basis risk, the mismatch between those funds and the underlying indices with which you can trade. And generally, that will drive the selection of those funds that are to be included there. And you'll generally have a measure, often on an R-squared basis, which everyone would be familiar with, that a certain cutoff where you would say, well, we need to include this, we can't exclude this, we might need to look at other ways of hedging this fund, or we may just totally exclude the selection of that fund. But it is primarily the main driver of the fund selection process. And of course, to get rid of all of that, you could use a passive fund. Still be a tiny bit of basis risk in there, but it should be near zero. And of course, you have the advantage that it decreases the cost of the guarantee. So how are we going to attack these types of issues is generally by diversification, which means having a block of business that's large enough that you get some sort of natural trade-offs there. So just a little example as to how this might look in reality. The table down the bottom just shows a selection of five managed funds. And it's looking at a regression against the global equity industries with liquid derivatives, i.e. the ones that you're going to use to hedge these liabilities. And what the table shows is it looks at the R squareds, the first five row there. That's just regressing the funds straight against the index. And then it shows the average R squared, which is says they're 92%. So that's just the average of the five above it. And then the 98% is the R squared of the combined portfolio. So if I combine those funds all into one master fund, if you like, and regress that against the index, you can see a significant improvement in the tracking of that. So diversification across funds, both in the types of funds and the managers and the geographical location, will enable you to get a better fit to your index. Pretty much one of the only effective ways of reducing the of increasing the R squared for a managed fund. Asset correlations, which is something that attracts a lot of attention from people, sometimes probably too much. Correlations are very volatile, pretty poorly understood, and relied on probably a little bit too much. That being said, you need correlations in your model. So the problems we get is that people don't agree on correlations. You've got issues with the length of the observation. You've got issues with the time periods. Where people don't agree on correlations, you get differences in pricing assumptions, and hence you get differences in price. So getting a stable set of correlations can often be a tricky issue. And as it says there, it's the appropriate margin to use in pricing is going to be based around these. So how do we combat this uncertainty in asset correlations? Again, we've got a table down the bottom which tries to highlight how this would be reduced in practice. What it shows is the correlations for two products, but we've got four indices there regressed against the ASX. Now, you can see the correlations, the 10, 5-year and 1-year. I guess what we're trying to show in that top right hand is that the correlations are quite volatile across the 10, the 5 and the 1, and if you were looking at that table and trying to come up with an assumption to put in your paper, you would be struggling to know which one to look at, and you would probably take some average of those. What's shown down underneath that is that whilst the correlations might be quite unstable there, the actual hedge costs associated with these products are stable, even though there's significant movement in the correlations. So it shows that whilst correlations of individual indices to individual indices might vary widely, when you're actually implementing a hedge program on top of these things, the hedge costs are quite stable. And finally, just talk pretty quickly about counterparty credit risk, hot topic at the moment, particularly when you're in a new market and you're trying to encourage capital providers to put up money for these guarantees. It's an issue that's been highlighted recently by the whole subprime fiasco and some pretty serious, semi-large players having to fall out of the market. Generally a lot of the counterparty risk is derived through the over-the-counter transactions that go on between insurance companies, investment banks, etc. It's generally to do with some type of risk transfer, and in return you get fed back some credit risk. So any risk that you want to transfer to someone, you're going to get back some credit risk. That's hard to avoid, but it's not hard to minimise. There's certain things you can do to minimise that sort of risk, particularly when you're looking at longer term products, particularly longer term guarantees. And the ways you might go about doing this is to, well, the obvious one is don't do OTC transactions. Have a clearinghouse in between you and your counterparty. That's not always, particularly when you have fancy guarantees and not vanilla options, that's not always going to be that easy. So in the end, you might need something that's been structured. In that case, when we're talking about trying to provide capital on a general basis where you don't have an exchange traded instrument, there are several things you can do in terms of mitigating the credit risk associated with the providers of credit. And that really, in the end, as the guarantee provider, if you're seeking a reinsurance solution, is really the only risk you're left with. So the tactic that's probably getting most acceptance in the local market is the development of a reinsurance pool type solution. And this involves a centrally administered internal independent party. So you're looking at the funds and the capital being provided by a range of capital providers, be they reinsurers, be they investment banks, of a particular credit rating. And this can all be specified in the pool agreement. There's a few advantages of that, but the biggest one is you're just exposed to the credit risk of the pool rather than the credit risk of the individual. And if you're looking at credit ratings above a particular level, say AA or something like that, if you were to have a pool of four of them, then the risk is significantly reduced. I mean, in fact, you would be requiring three or four global reinsurers to fall over all at once. And I'd suggest if that was happening, you'd probably have bigger problems in your company at that time anyway. It provides transparency, but I think it provides security. Also in the fact that the guarantee provider, I guess the writer of this business, can be comfortable knowing that this pool is administered by a third party. It's not any one of the capital providers has a hold on the product or a hold on the capital being provided, and hence can't... I guess the tail can't wag the dog in that respect. I would suggest that for most of the providers of these types of products in Australia who don't have capital, which is quite a lot, particularly in the super fund industry, the development of a reinsurance pool solution for them will be central to being able to offer this product and to be able to convince their shareholders and their board that the risk that's going to come back to these companies with very small balance sheets is mitigated as far as possible. I'll just pass back to Jeff.
Thanks, John. The last risk that I wanted to highlight is operational risk, and this is operational risk really from the perspective of a hedging program. And what the diagram is trying to show is that there's a ton of things going on, and whether you'd view it as all part of one model or a range of models sitting across different departments, or if there's alternative risk transfer outside from the seller of the guarantee to the third party, at some point all these steps are happening. And the first stage is just that generally in an insurance company environment, the information is sitting on a policy administration system, and a lot of times these might be older legacy systems, so there's sometimes issues with transferring that information into information that's just relevant to the valuation of the guarantee. And from that, that information would get fed into the valuation engine. And sometimes usually these things are done on a regular basis, weekly, nightly, or even more frequently. And then you involve there's data from the capital markets, and so it needs to be checked that data is consistent. And then that's all going to produce fed into some sort of trade positioning system, and which would result in trades, and then those get combined with trades that are already in the books. And then at the end of the hedging program, there's internal reporting models. So the main message with this is, well, just checks and balances are important between the different steps. And also, as complex as a hedging program structure is, you would expect no surprises really on a day-to-day basis. Meaning, when you do a nightly evaluation, standard practice would be to calculate your liability book shocked over a large range of market parameters. So even if the market were to drop, as we've seen recently, after that happens, the resulting position really shouldn't be out of the bounds of what you've predicted ahead of time. And so one standard practice might be that any trades made aren't done until the liability option value can be reconciled, given the changes that are made. So I think with that, I'm wrap it up. As the tagline says, intelligent product design is really crucial in designing, because after the risks are understood, anything that is hedgeable will be hedged, and it's just important to structure the product so that you're not exposing yourself to any sort of adverse policyholder behavior. And again, look at the products on a holistic basis. Is the intent of the product to increase funds under management? Well, then some risk tolerances might be relaxed in terms of the guarantee, or is the guarantee supposed to be profitable in its own right? That might have a different set of criteria. And if for the issuer that risk is uncomfortable, then there are numerous options for transferring risk around. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. We have about 15 minutes or so for questions, so please feel free to ask questions. If there's a mic just up there, so if you have a question, please come up and state your name for the record. It would be good. Anyone got any questions? Zach?
Thanks, guys. That was very good. I've just got two questions. One is just to talk about the reinsurance pool. If my understanding, if that's only to be used in situations where you've had to get a structured sort of product from a bank as opposed to exchange-traded options, what are the benefits of that as opposed to just getting a credit default swap on that bank?
Can we go first on that?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I guess just to explain it in a bit more detail, I guess I don't really see it in quite that way as being more of a structured solution. I actually see it as much more akin to what the US model is currently, where you have a bunch of individual life insurance companies that are writing this business and they're internally manufacturing the hedging program. And that's all well and good. You know, those companies are selling business. It's on their books. They're writing it to increase the inflows there. Now, where the development of that business is going to, it's developing further, where it's now trying to embed these types of guarantees directly within 401k plans. So within the Australian market, the equivalent is you approach an industry fund and say, well, look, you guys have the perfect distribution model for this type of stuff. You do it essentially for group risk. How do you go about doing this for various income type guarantees? Now, the biggest concern that they have in structuring this up is, well, there's a counterparty exposure there at the end of the day, and the types of contracts we're talking about are 25, 30 years. So that's, I think, where the concept of pooling that type of exposure and having the right mechanisms in place, so if a counterparty does blow up, the pool can take over until you bring in additional parties, is actually something that's much more palatable to those types of organisations.
Then the other question I had is, I noticed the reference in there to passive investments. Sort of in my opinion, one of the biggest troubles these products are going to face in Australia is just the fees. By the time you have your admin fee, your funds management fee and your guarantee fee. So it seems to me that a passive index solves a few problems in that it removes the investment management fee and it removes the basis risk to make it a cheaper product. The obvious disadvantage is it removes the investment management fee. So I'm just wondering if you've had any experience in sort of companies, their thoughts on that type of product as opposed to one with sort of underlying funds.
Sure. That is a problem that many companies do face, because the passive fund is sometimes harder to sell. In the States, I think a typical option is that there's a lot of big-name Fidelity or other large provider funds are offered for a marketing point of view. And also with the fund management fees, they might have higher fees up front for a non-passive fund, but then sometimes there's kickback arrangements. But that being said, there is an increasing interest in the passive funds. If in the type of structure where the company isn't using their own internal funds, so if the only option is to use third-party funds, the passive investment is a lot of times seen as a popular choice. But like you said, there is less fee income coming to somebody in that case. But when you look in the terms of the guarantee, any fee that you're paying to your fund manager is a fee that's deducted from the fund and is therefore just paid back to the policyholder in the form of the guarantee. So any reduction in fees coming off the account value is just a reduction in the guarantee cost.
Yeah, I'll just add as well, there's some interesting dynamics because you look at the Australian, you know, exactly what you say is exactly right. You look at the Australian environment and fees on retail funds are, you know, substantially higher than you know, equivalent funds in the US, which, you know, you tend to, yeah, I guess, argue away as being a bit of a scale issue maybe. But at the same time, you know, you've got, I guess, an Australian market where, you know, there are some factors here with things like, I guess, interest rates, which operate at a premium to US markets and various other bits and pieces, which help to bring the guarantee cost down. So you get a little bit of an offset there, but you know, comments are still pretty valid.
Any other questions?
Hi, Wade Tubman, PwC. It's probably not 100% relevant to the topic, but you mentioned before regarding the fees and the US model of a single fee for the guarantee and the possible clean slate with an Australian model of having layers. Cross-subsidies are obviously something pretty common in the insurance industry. It's what, you know, insurance is all about, but not so common in the investment management industry. Just wondering, while it's not quite on the exact topic, how people manage that.
I think it's a bit, as Jeff sort of said when he was presenting, you know, the US, they've gone that way for simplicity, I guess, and it's worked well for them. They've developed, you know, they've sold a lot of business and the products have been very successful. And I think the key thing there is that eventually, you know, you can rely on policyholders to be rational for a certain period of time, but they generally wisen up, you know, later. And what we've started to see in the US is people actually do more actively select, you know, riskier funds. So, you know, whilst the US was predominantly and still is single sort of fee based model, it's changing to where they've got, you know, different rates across various options. The Australian market, you know, Access products are sort of the first leader, I guess, in that sense, and they've gone directly to that. So, you know, you can go to the extreme of having a separate fee straight basis for just about every single fund, which would create, you know, overwhelming complexity. But I think to come up with some differentiator where you've got, you know, a small number of fee bases, you know, based on, you know, sort of a risk classification of the underlying funds is, you know, not an unacceptable approach to take.
I'd probably just add, I mean, you know, as long as it doesn't get too complicated, you're also giving the investor a bit more hands-on in terms of their investments, and as long as they appreciate and understand the types of things which make a fund high, medium and low risk, say, I think as long as the complexity doesn't get too extreme, then you're offering them a bit of flexibility in terms of their investment decisions and probably a bit more empowering for them.
Hi, Ian Lachlan. Just following on from Zach's question, are you aware of any market research about, for Australia, about the interest or demand for these sorts of things at the retail level?
I guess there's nothing public that I'm aware of. To be fair, I guess there's a wealth of information in other markets about how these things have segmented down and which sort of customer. I guess where the opportunities lie. I guess there's a report. I think some of our guys in the US did, which looked at it and essentially classified the market into, you know, three different segments. Where you've got the upper affluent, you know, section, which generally had, I think, you know, they had a sort of accumulated savings, you know, million plus, and basically those guys really, you know, these types of products weren't sort of focused at that segment simply because they, you know, once you get to that level, you're really looking at very highly tailored advice around things like issues like tax management and those types of things. I think where the key demographic for these types of things is targeted is really that middle to mass market, you know, simply because it removes the need to go out and start to parcel up lots of different, you know, products to essentially get to some guaranteed income at the end of the day, and it simplifies that process down. So, you know, someone who would, you know, sit in a default option that might be, you know, say a 60-40 fund or something, can come along and now say, well, if I take this guarantee, I've provided myself protection, you know, with an income for the rest of my life, and I know what that amount is. Now, given that I've taken that protection and I'm prepared to pay 75 basis points, you know, am I prepared to change my investment allocation instead of going 60-40? I'll now go 70-30 and take that. So it actually gives them the power to customize their asset allocation or risk profile more appropriately. But you know, I think the stuff that we've seen anecdotally with a lot of sort of market testing conducted by various organisations is that the message is there's still a fair bit of education that needs to be done on the products themselves and consumers. It's a new concept and the issues are new and consumers out there, like the guys were saying yesterday in the plenaries, you know, a lot of them are, you know, there's a financial literacy hurdle that you need to get over. So, you know, coming up with a trade-off where you've got a simple product that can be communicated easily is going to be key.
And also in Australia, while the VA populars aren't VA products aren't as popular yet, there are guaranteed investment structures out there offered through such as Macquarie Bank, which basically gives somebody the option to even single stock investments with a put option later on top of that, and kind of bundled into sort of a margin lending structure. So there are guaranteed investments in the market now.
To toss in a little bit of experience that I've had way back many years ago, and trust it's still relevant. When you're offering three options of high, medium, and low, I've tended to find that in the sales situation, someone selling it will make it either high sales pitch or a low sales pitch, and that if you want a medium, you just buy a mix of both, so you may be able to save one of your product offers.
Just got more simple.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's like, and then that bears out in the US where they just go, well, there is no option. You know, you pick your funds, and here's a fee. I guess there's always going to be an element of crafting these things so it gives the advisor, you know, enough stuff to feel as though they're adding value, which is part of the problem of the advisory process that was harped on about yesterday. But finding a way to escape that is a bit of a tough one.
Just on financial literacy, I believe that in the US sometimes people will purchase these guarantees and invest in cash units, which doesn't strike me as being very good value for money.
Duncan Rawlinson, sorry, just one quick question. I'm not familiar with the US Social Security system, so I'm just, given what you were saying about where the market might be, how does the age pension in Australia compare with whatever the equivalent is in the US, and to what extent does that represent an area of important difference when thinking about why, say, these sorts of guarantees sell very well in the US and what that might mean for how they should or will do in Australia, given the age pension underpin?
Sure. There's a great presentation earlier today about it was a comparison about the US and Australia pension systems. And while the US equivalent of an age pension is a little bit higher, the 401k contributions, which are the equivalent of super, are slightly lower. But there's a lot of similarities there in that when a U.S. retiree reaches retirement age, there's a lump sum of assets there that accumulated over the lifetime. So I think a lot of the comparisons we make between the U.S. market and the Australian market aren't just made because we've primarily our experiences in the U.S., but also because there's a lot of similarities there with between the super and the 401k. So I would expect for popularity of these guarantees, it would be pretty similar.
Yeah, and the interesting comment that was made today, I think, was I think Steve Schubert was doing a comparison of the DC systems, and he brought out that essentially in the US the pension there is not means tested, so in a sense that there's a different benefit. So, you know, I think the key point, Duncan, is when you're looking at these types of products that, you know, to look at them in the absence of how they would interact with the age pension is an error, and you need to consider, you know, how they're going to sit on top. I think, you know, from a financial planning perspective, and I guess I think it's a paper that Richard and Chris Condon did yesterday, you know, essentially made the assertion that, you know, if a retiree ends up where they're, you know, fundamentally, you know, solely relying on the age pension, then it's a failure of the financial plan. Now, you know, it's going to vary depending upon what sort of assets they've accumulated to the point when they do decide to retire, and that's why, you know, a lifetime income with, for someone which has got maybe, you know, less than $100,000 is going to be a relatively small amount. So I think the lifetime products may be less relevant there, and what you're really looking for is to say, well, you'd rather draw down or have protected 10% of your accumulated assets over a shorter time horizon and go a bit more aggressive in your asset allocation, and then factor in that you're going to get age pension at some point. But, you know, the way these things interact is crucial.
I think we have time for one or two more.
Andrew Fisher. I've just got a quick question about the difference between the markets US and Australia. One important difference perhaps is the regulated minimum withdrawal rates that have been legislated in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of impact does that have on the product design that we need to think about in Australia as opposed to the US, and is that going to impact on, I suppose, product demand as well?
It certainly needs to factor into it, but the nature of the withdrawals, the minimum, the withdrawal schedule specified by the Australian government, it generally sits underneath the level of withdrawals that these guarantees offer. So we've built that into a lot of our pricing models, and it generally just doesn't have much of an effect. It does come into play when you talk about you might not be able to give, under certain structures, be able to give people the option to delay withdrawals. But for a lifetime withdrawal benefit or a fixed term GMWB, the minimum pension factors sit underneath the guaranteed withdrawal rates at current market rates and interest rates. Now, if interest rates were to decrease a lot, that might not be the case anymore.
Okay, in that case, we'll wrap up, because I believe our time's nearly up. I'd just like to thank Wade, Jeff and John for a very excellent presentation. If we don't thank them in the usual way.